offer their prayers by saying, Praja Ishaha. The Prajapatis created by Lord Brahma, who have created generations of living entities. Vayam, we, te, of you, para isha, O Supreme Lord, avishishtaha, born, na, not, yena, by whom Hiranyakashipu, Prajaha, living entities, Vai, indeed, Srijamaha, we create, Nishittaha, being forbidden, Saha, he, Hiranyakashipu, Ishaha, this, Twaya, by you, Vinavakshaha, whose chest has been split. Nu, indeed. Shete, lies down. Jagat Mangalam, for the auspiciousness of the whole world. Satvamurte, in this transcendental form of pure goodness. Avataraha, this incarnation. So, translation. The Prajapatis offer their prayers as follows. O Supreme Lord, Lord of even Brahma and Shiva, we the Prajapatis were created by you to execute your orders, but we were forbidden by Hiranyakashipu to create any more good progeny. Now the demon is lying dead before us, his chest pierced by you. Let us therefore offer our respectful obeisances unto you, whose incarnation in this form of pure goodness is meant for the welfare of the entire universe. So there's no purport to this text, so we'll go on to the next text, which has a purport. It's about the Gandharvas, and I'll just read it. Shri Gandharva uchu vayam vibhote natanachakayaka yenatmasad virya valaujasakritaha saisha nito bhavatara shamimam kim upatasta kushalaya kalpate. The translation is, the inhabitants of Gandharva Loka prayed, Your Lordship, we ever engage in your service by dancing and singing in dramatic performances. But this Hiranyakashipu, by the influence of his bodily strength and valor, brought us under his subjugation. Now he is brought to this low condition by your Lordship. What benefit can result from the activities of such an upstart as Hiranyakashipu? Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. By being a very obedient servant to the Supreme Lord, one becomes extremely powerful in bodily strength, influence, and effulgence. Whereas the fate of demoniac upstarts is ultimately to fall down like Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyakashipu and persons like him may be very powerful for some time, but the obedient servants of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, like the demigods, remain powerful always. They are victorious over the influence of Hiranyakashipu by the grace of the Supreme Lord. So, Omagana Timirandasya Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshur Un Meditam Yena Tasmai Shigurave Namaha. So, there's three topics I'd like to talk about today. One is about the Prajapatis, the other one is about the Gandharvas, and the final one is a pretty scary topic. And it refers to Prabhupada's purport here. And I'll explain that at the end. Okay. The first thing is the Prajapatis. Prajapatis, of course, are responsible for creating good progeny. Progeny means children, filling the universe up with living entities. And the way they do that is very interesting. Of course, some of them create living entities without the necessity of a male-female interaction. But in general, the praja means those who are born, come from the consciousness of the prajapatis. Consciousness means, even in this world, when you have a man and woman combined and there's children, the children are a reflection of the consciousness of the parents. That's why in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, we recommend something called the Garbhadhan Samskara. Garbhadhan Samskara means the seed-giving ceremony by which the parents develop or try to develop good consciousness so that the child or the soul that is attracted to the womb of the mother is actually a good devotee. So that's a very important step in having good children. Of course, it's not the be-all and end-all of having good children. There's two things. There's nature and nurture. And I'll explain what that means. Nature means what someone is born with. And nurture is what happens afterwards. So sometimes we see that nurture is actually more important than nature. And I'll give you some practical examples of that. One is, actually there's two examples I can think of, or several examples, where the children actually have fantastic nature, but then they became demons. And one example I'm going to give is one of the sons of Krishna. Krishna had a son, and Krishna appeared as the Varaha manifestation of God. Varaha means the boar, the incarnation of the Lord. And when he touched the earth planet, then he touched the earth planet with his tusk. And as we know, the Supreme Lord can do anything with any one of his senses, right? Angani, Asha, Shakalan, Driadri, Chimanti. So he can eat with his eyes. He can eat with his ears. I mean, that's why when we offer on the altar, we say certain prayers. And if one is a very advanced pujari, like Vishnu Kavacha, then Krishna will eat everything on his plate. And when you go to take the plate off the altar, which I'm sure it's happened many times to you, right? See, he's admitting. Then there'll be nothing left on the plate. And then you'll think, oh, did I make that offering? Actually, Sachimata, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mother, had that experience when she was offering to Nimai after Lord Chaitanya left Navadvip, that sometimes she would offer and there'd be nothing left on the plate. She was thinking, did I actually make the offering? And then she'd make another offering. That's described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So anyway, so Krishna, he can do anything with any one of his senses. So as Lord Bore, he touched the earth, and the earth is personified as Bhumi. And by touching the earth, she gave birth to a little child who actually had such good qualities because he was the son of Bhumi, a pure devotee, an expansion of Lakshmi Devi, actually, and the son of Krishna. I mean, you can't find better parents, and you can't accuse Krishna of having bad consciousness at the time of conception. Krishna, you were not Krishna conscious. You didn't chant your rounds properly. So you can't really, I mean, that's not appropriate to say that. So, but by bad association, they changed his name when he got initiated in the Asura Sampradaya. They edited an Asura to the end of his name. His name was originally Boma. And then he became Boma Sura. So just like when you take initiation, sometimes if you have a certain name, sometimes the guru will add something to your name. Or at least use the first letter of your previous name sometimes. Not always, Prabhupada didn't do it always. So he became Bhumasura, and he had the audacity to kidnap all these princesses. So Bhumi, who was the mother, understood that Krishna was going to try to kill her son. Imagine killing your own son. Because when he became a demon. And Bhumi said to Krishna, please, don't kill our son. And Krishna said, don't worry. I will not kill him unless you give me permission. So she was thinking, let me take some water. With this weather change, it causes a little mucus when you get older. So she was thinking, I will never give him permission. I mean, come on, you know, what mother's going to give permission to kill a kid? But Krishna is ultimately much more tricky than any lady, especially Lakshmi, or an expansion of Lakshmi. So when he went to attack Bulmasura, he brought with him, does anyone know who? Who? Satyabhama. And Bhumi's an expansion of Satyabhama. So he brought with him Satyabhama, and Bulmasura was attacking, and what did Satyabhama say? Kill him! Kill him! And so Krishna said, thank you for giving me permission. So then Krishna, unfortunately, had to kill his own son. Terrible, isn't it? But anyway, the son became a demon. He was threatening the whole universe and kidnapping girls, you know. Then what can you do? So even in the case of Advaitacharya, of course Advaitacharya didn't kill his sons. But Advaitacharya had six sons. And three of them became devotees. And three of them became like impersonalists or speculators like that. So Advaitacharya rejected three of his sons. Three he considered bona fide sons and three unbona fide sons. So here you have God. I'm making the point, even God having children, sometimes the children fall into bad association. So what does that mean? That if we want to have good progeny, then practically speaking, the most important thing is good association. And then on the other hand, you have people who are born with demoniac qualities, and then they become devotees. Like that typical story in the Ramayana of Ratnakara. He was a dacoit, and by chanting Ram, 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 even though he didn't mean to chant Ram, 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 he was meaning to chant Det, 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 Mar, Mar, Mar. He became a great devotee. So I would say of the two, association is more important than even with what one is born with. I mean, our whole movement is filled with people who came from, as Prabhupada said, mixed castes of unknown origin. Although many of us like to brag, you know, I was born in a good family Malachas or whatever. And, you know, my parents were very Krishna conscious. At least, they didn't know it, but they were Krishna conscious. So, but anyway, I mean, so by association, like it said, by the proper initiation, it's just like a touchstone that can turn regular metal. Sanatana Goswami gives this example, regular metal to gold. So the proper initiation then, initiation means not just getting your name, Jai, I become a pure devotee, but initiation is part of the process by which one accepts the order of the spiritual master, chants the holy names, follows the sadhana process, etc. And then one can become a great devotee of the Lord, even though one is born in a very unfortunate family. So we have two things, you know, someone of low birth becoming high and someone of high birth becoming low. So therefore, this is very important. I have important principles for us to understand that it's very important to avoid bad association for the devotees. And even someone of high birth or low birth becoming high and then by bad association they fall down. As Krishna says in the Gita, Karinam Guna Sangasya Sarasad Janma Jonishu, that our entanglement in this material world is due to guna sangha, association with certain modes of nature. So anyway, so this is what I like to talk about. The first verse, if we want good progeny, or if we want to be good progeny, because we are progeny of someone, then we have to have good association and avoid bad association. Second verse is about the Gandharvas. The Gandharvas are like dancers and singers. Both the Gandharvas and the Prajapatis come from the higher planets. There's many different planets or planetary systems within the universe. And these are higher living entities. So the Gandharvas are very powerful living entities, and they live in Gandharva Loka, of course, as described here. And their business, basically, is to glorify their lordship, and to glorify Krishna by singing songs and dances. And there's some very interesting stories about Gandharvas. As Krishna says in the Gita, of Gandharvas, I am who? Does anyone know that verse in the Bhagavad Gita?
any Bhagavad Gita scholars here?
Of Gandharvas, I am Chitraratha.
And so Krishna is indicating that Chitraratha of the Gandharvas is actually the most important of all the Gandharvas, or a manifestation of the Lord's potency. Says that 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita deals with the vibhutis, or the energies of the Supreme Personality, the potencies of the Lord. So it's a very interesting story about this particular Gandharva, Chitraratha. He didn't always have the name Chitraratha. And that's a story. This is a story from the Mahabharata. He was named Anga Parana before. Agneya Parana, or something like that. So the story goes as follows, that once upon a time, this Gandharva, he was enjoying with his wives. And he was enjoying with his wives in the Ganges River. Now the Gandharvas have certain times for enjoying with their wives. I mean, they have many wives anyway. So what happened is, as he was enjoying, or attempting to enjoy, because in this material world we know the enjoyment is very much illusory. So the Pandavas happened to come. And when he saw the Pandavas and he was there with his wives, he got very angry. And what he did is he started to attack the Pandavas. And specifically, he was fighting with Arjuna. So he fired his Gandharva weapon at Arjuna. And Arjuna said to him, because you are using celestial weapons, therefore I have the right to use a celestial weapon against you. So he fired the Agneya weapon. Arjuna fired the Agneya, which means the Agni weapon. Agni weapon is a weapon of fire. And what happened is, when he fired that at this Gandharva, the Gandharva's chariot burnt to ashes, and the Gandharva fell to the ground. And so from that point onward, the Gandharva was known as Chitraratha, which means one whose chariot is burnt. Before, he was known as someone whose chariot, or someone whose chariot is like the sun, or like fire, and now his chariot was like burnt ashes. So then he bowed down at Arjuna's feet, and he said, please, you know, save me, save me, save me, forgive me. And Arjuna said, you know, why did you attack me like this? And then the Gandharva explained, because I was enjoying in the river with my wives. And nobody likes to be disturbed when they're enjoying with their wives. And he said to Arjuna that you were able to defeat me because you were a brahmachari. Ordinarily, kshatriyas can't defeat Gandharvas, but because you were a brahmachari, Arjuna had not yet gotten married. The Pandavas were on their way to attend the Swayamvara of Draupadi at that point. But only one of them was married at that point. It was Bhimsen. Bhimsen had married that Rakshasini, Hidimba. So anyway, so he said that you were able to defeat me for this purpose, but he said you also had some other faults too. One fault was, this is very interesting actually, one fault was that you just graduated from Gurukul, the ashram of your spiritual master, previously, and for some time, and you're not married yet. So even though you're a brahmachari, it's not appropriate for a kshatriya to be a brahmachari. Which is actually quite interesting. So those of you who want to be kshatriyas, you should get married immediately, or else it's a fault. So, you know, we have so many nice girls here, so you can choose. So, and if you're a Brahmin, you have a choice. But if you're a Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra, you don't have a choice. You got to get married. Too bad. So, so this Chitraratha at that time said to Arjuna that that's one of your faults. Another fault you have is that you don't have a Brahmin with you. Because you're supposed to be, as you're on pilgrimage, because you're not a Brahmin, you always, as a Kshatriya, you always have to keep a Brahmin. That's a very important point in the Varnashram system, that a Kshatriya always has to be accompanied by a Brahmin to give him advice. Because the Kshatriya is controlled by the mode of passion. And that means, passion sometimes means you're responding to some insult. I mean, let's take the example of Yudhisthira Maharaj. even though he was very exalted, when he was challenged in the gambling match, as a Kshatriya, he responded, even though he knew, and many people knew, that Shakuni had loaded dice. You know what loaded dice is? Anyone know that? That means dice that are weighted in a certain way, so when you throw them, if you know how to throw them, they always end up in the way you want. So Yudhisthira, you know, because that's the Kshatriya spirit. But a Brahmin could say, no, you know, I'm not going to play dice. This is nonsense, Maya. Or a Kshatriya also, when he's approached by a lady, and the lady says, will you marry me? I mean, this is in the previous age. Don't get worried about these things now. Then the Kshatriya has to accept. It's actually considered a fault if it's a eligible lady. It's considered a fault if he doesn't accept. So therefore, one of the faults that Arjuna had was that he didn't have a Brahmin with him. And therefore, he got this Brahmin, Domya, who later accompanied the Pandavas. So this is a story of Mahabharata. But there's more to the story than this. There's quite an interesting story about Chitrartha, since we're talking about Gandharvas, and the verse talks about Gandharvas. That later on, when the Pandavas were in exile because they'd lost the gambling match, the second gambling match, they were actually sent into exile. The first one was the one where they attempted to disrobe Draupadi and Krishna saved Draupadi. So they were in exile, and it wasn't the year of their incognito exile, that means where they couldn't be found. It was one of the years where they were openly in exile. So the Kurus, headed up by Duryodhana, were thinking, we want to really embarrass the Pandavas. So we're going to go to where the Pandavas were, or are, with all of our entourage. Entourage means, you know, our wives and bands and all the paraphernalia and stuff like that. So they thought, we're really going to show them. You know, sometimes, like, if someone's suffering or someone's lower than you, you want to just, like, show them how great you are. This is material consciousness, actually. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, in material consciousness, we take joy in seeing others suffer. In spiritual consciousness, we feel pain to feel others, see others suffer, and we do something to try to alleviate their suffering. So anyway, so the Kurus went there to show off in front of the Pandavas, but who happened to be there but Chitrartha again enjoying with his wives? And what happened is that Chitrartha this time was able to overpower the Kurus because Arjuna wasn't there. And he captured them all, including Duryodhana. And so there was poor Duryodhana, you know, he feels some compassion for the soul, the poor soul, captured by the Gandharvas. And basically, the Pandavas were told about this. And so when they were told about this, Bhimsen thought, this Hari Bol, this is the best thing that ever happened to us. What we were trying to do with so much endeavor has been accomplished by the Gandharvas. And Bhimsen was, you know, completely in ecstasy. And actually, everyone except for Yudhisthira was in ecstasy. The reason Yudhisthira was not in ecstasy was that Yudhisthira is called Ajatashatru. Ajatashatru means he whose enemy is never born. Now, of course, this is the quality of a pure devotee, too. As Lord Kapiladev says, that the qualities of the Vaishnava is that he's tolerant, merciful, he's a friend to all living entities, etc. And he has no enemy. His enemy is never born. The Kshatriya has an enemy. Although Yudhisthira was a Kshatriya, he had many brahminical qualities. So he never hated anyone. And you contrast that with Bhimsen, who was like a trampled serpent. Trampled serpent means he's out to get you. Just like there was that story, someone told me this story yesterday, that they found a serpent in Prabhupada's bathroom. And they killed him. And then Prabhupada said, well, you got a problem there, because the serpent has a wife. And the wife is going to try to get him. So the devotees were looking all over for the wife of the serpent. And Prabhupada wasn't worried, of course. He's detached from these things. There's even a story that one Once upon a time, someone killed a serpent, and then he got in a plane to fly back to wherever he was flying back to. And the wife of the serpent snuck into the luggage, and when he got back where he was, he opened his bag. And death, so. That's cool, isn't it? So anyway, so getting back to this whole story, the Pandavas, most of them were in ecstasy, especially Bhimsen. But Yudhisthira Maharaj, not considering anyone to be his enemy, he said, look, we got to save them. It's our duty. They may not like us, but they're our cousin brothers. We got to save them. And the other Pandavas were saying, what? How can we do that? And Yudhisthira said, it's your duty. And of course, they all followed Yudhisthira. That was their brotherly affection. They were really connected with each other. One of the main themes of the Mahabharata is the love that the brothers felt for each other. We talked about this the other day. That they just function as one unit. Which also can teach us a lesson as far as ourselves being members of the Krishna consciousness movement. We should function as one unit. In other words, love, cooperation, as Srila Prabhupada said, that will be, show how much we love him. So, anyway, Yudhisthira said, gotta save him. So Arjuna said, all right, no problem, I'm gonna go save him. So Arjuna went, and basically didn't have to fight with the Gandharvas, because at that point, Chitrartha was his friend. And Chitrartha, in addition to being his friend, gave Arjuna some benedictions, which Arjuna later used in the Battle of Kurukshetra. He gave him 100 horses that even if one horse was killed, there would always be 100 horses. And he gave him the weapon of illusion. So Arjuna could basically use the Gandharva tricks. And Gandharvas were expert in like magical stuff and illusion. And he could appear one place, disappear in another place. So he was given those powers by Chitrartha. So anyway, so he basically went to his friend Chitrartha and said, you know, please release my cousin brothers. And Chitrartha said, why? You know, they were attacking you. They caused you all these problems. They tried to kill Bhimsen, you know, poisoning him and through other means. And Arjuna said, well, it's Yudhisthira's order. I just have to follow the order of my brother, my elder brother. And so Duryodhana was released. But at that point, Duryodhana was so depressed that he had been defeated in this way by the Gandharvas and ultimately released by Arjuna, who he hated, that Duryodhana decided to commit suicide. So he sat down in meditation, because even the demons at that time, they can meditate, do yoga and stuff like that, and he got ready to leave his body. He just sat there, and while he was sitting there, his demon friends and subtle bodies pulled him out of his body and gave him a pep talk. You know what a pep talk is? Mm-hmm. Like before a football game or something like that. So they gave him a pep talk and said, don't worry, we are going to take over the consciousness of Grandfather Bhishma. We are going to take over the consciousness of Dronacharya and Kripacharya. And so they will be possessed by us. Imagine. Great devotees. I mean, Dronacharya, Kripacharya, Grandfather Bhishma were great devotees. Why were they able to be possessed? Does anyone know? Why?
Because they were eating in the kitchen of
Duryodhana. Because they're eating impure food. I mean, that's why Prabhupada also told us, you know, only eat food cooked by devotees. Because if you eat something cooked by someone, their consciousness enters into your consciousness, or their consciousness affects your consciousness. Just like in Ayurveda, you understand that when you eat something, it eventually becomes blood. So the blood is the carrier of consciousness. Just like if you have to get a transfusion, you get a transfusion from a devotee. Find a pure devotee with the same blood type. You know, that's why all the devotees should have their blood typed. So when you get a transfusion, you go around and find, do you chant your rounds? Can I have your blood? I have the best blood type, A+. course, that's not a universal donor. O is a universal donor. So too bad. So anyway, so the blood is the carrier of consciousness. So getting back to the story, is that Duryodhana just got so excited and happy by that, he jumped up out of meditation and said, now I'm going to win, and he was assured of victory. So that's the story of the Gandharva. So Chicharatha, who Krishna says represents him as far as the opulence is. Now the final point I want to mention, something that's a little scary. It says, you may not find it scary, but Prabhupada says in the purport, by being a very obedient servant of the Supreme Lord, one becomes extremely powerful in bodily strength, influence, and effulgence. I find that scary. Now, the reason I find it scary is because of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura's analysis of anarthas. Anartha means something you don't want. So what don't you want? An old car? Yeah, no, what you don't want is lust, anger, greed, illusion, envy, fear, bewilderment, like that. So anarthas come from different sources. Anarthas come from sinful activities, obviously. If you do something that's contrary to the Manasamhita, as we mentioned in the previous class, anarthas come from that. Like if you begin to drink liquor, obviously you're going to get some anarthas. From the modes of nature. And then anarthas come even from pious activities. That's interesting too. Pious activities. I mean, if you do something good not connected with Krishna, like planting trees, nothing wrong with planting trees, but you're not doing it out of service for Krishna, you're just doing it for some mundane purpose. Or let's say you look at the mountains here, which are very beautiful, and you say, oh, how beautiful these mountains. You just like meditate on them. That's the mode of goodness. One becomes attached to a false sense of happiness. So, and anarthas also come from offenses against devotees. I mean, that's obvious. Or against the deities. Or against the holy place. But the final one that scares me is anarthas come from byproducts of bhakti. So here it mentions, one becomes extremely powerful in bodily strength, influence, and effulgence. Whew. You know, if that happened to me, I'd be really scared. Because I'd be thinking I'm so great. So, obviously, you know, we see devotees, as we advance in devotional service, the very things that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says he's not interested in, Dhanam, Janam, Sundari, like you were chanting this morning, come to one. Dhanam, Janam, Sundari, he may have more access to money. Followers certainly come. Let's say one becomes one of those things called a guru. Actually, if one thinks he's a guru, he's a guru. That means he's a cow or an ass or something. But if one, then people start to appreciate him. You know, you become a leader, not even a guru. I mean, temple president, GBC, whatever. It's interesting, like, one's desires are unlimited. So first you want to be temple commander, then you want to be temple president or head pujari. And then you want to be temple, yeah, then you want to be regional secretary, GBC. Just like right now, we have this thing, if one wants to be a GBC, they have to go to the GBC college, right? So, actually, I was thinking, you know, in retrospect means looking back. I said, why would someone want to be a GBC? So, even though I am, I said, what do they get into? I'd much rather be just like a regular, humble devotee. So, So limited one's desires. You know, then you become guru. I want to be a guru, that's my aspiration. And then after that, the only place up is God. And then anyone would be God. That's the last snare of Maya. So it's not that a devotee actually thinks, I want to be God. But for all intents and purposes, he doesn't try, but that consciousness may affect him. You know, but what does it mean to want to be God? Ishwaroham aham bhogi siddhaham bhagavan sukhi. That's what Krishna says in the Gita, and he talks about the demoniac qualities. He says, I'm the controller. Ishwaro ham, the hum bhogi, I'm the enjoyer, bring me some bhoga. Siddhalam, I'm powerful. Balavam sukhi, also strong, and I am happy. So these are the things that are mentioned here, powerful in bodily strength, influence, and indulgence. And so then you have to worry about this Nadanam, Najanam, Nasundarim, Kavitam Bhav, Chagadisha Kamehe, Mamajanam, Nijanam, Ishwari, Bhavatad, Bhakti, Hoitiki, Dwehe. So it's dangerous. It's extremely dangerous. Like Prabhupada said one time, if one goes to Lanka, he can become Ravana. That means if you get power, then you can become like Ravana. And I'm writing a book about communication and everything. One chapter I talk about this. I mean, there's a mundane example, not in Krishna consciousness, of a person who was the founder acharya of the Ford Motor Company, Henry Ford. So when he first started the company, you know, he was just an extremely kind employer. He treated all of his employees like family. And according to his biography, when his company got very big, he had control over vast resources, then he became like an ogre. You know what an ogre is? An ogre, like, he's regularly torturing his employees and that, like that. So he changed due to that situation. So this is a very dangerous thing. So the question is, how do we guard against it? Well, many ways. One is we always keep an association of other devotees, especially peers. Peers means people on the same level, either managerially or spiritually, like that. And then another way is we serve everyone. We keep, let's say, injecting into our consciousness that we're amanina manadena, offering respects to everyone and serving everyone. And we also pray to Krishna. We also remain alert as to the tendency of becoming proud of these different aspects or potencies that Krishna may give us, or influence that Krishna may allow us, or even effulgence like that, as Prabhupada mentions here. And in this way, we can remain protected against these anarthas. So, because actually, we can become demoniac. And we've seen this happen before, even in our Krishna conscious movement, that demoniac tendencies may arise due to the byproducts of bhakti. So anyway, this is the final point I'd like to make. So, any questions or comments? Oh my God, it says class ends by 8:15. I didn't obey the instructions. Yes,
final. Just a very final for you, the Kshatriyas, the Pandavas, and did they have a Brahmana with them when they were actually traveling?
Yes, Domya. I mentioned that. Domya, after they were warned about this by Chicharatha, they looked around, they got Domya, who became their traveling Brahmana. Yeah. Yeah, after that they always made sure they had a Brahman with them.
I'm just a little confused as to who he was related with. So he was with the Pandavas.
Domya, yeah. Domya was D H A U M.
Can you elaborate why, you know, like you said, these yogis, they could, these people, Dronacharya, they could meditate, they're quite spiritually advanced.
Duryodhana, I was mentioning, yeah.
And someone like Maharaj, you just hear as a considered Dharma Raj.
Yeah.
Why he really needed to have someone within, like a Brahman?
Because that's the system. Even though Yudhisthira Maharaj, okay, I did mention the Yudhisthira Maharaj, even though he had brahminical tendencies, sometimes he slipped into the kshatriya mode of nature, like in the gambling match. Because when you're dealing with kshatriya things, like fighting, your consciousness can be affected. I mean, it's just natural. You're carrying around weapons. This was actually brought up in the Ramayana. In Sita Devi, it's a very interesting story in Valmiki Ramayana. Sita Devi was saying to Lord Ram, I'm very worried that you're carrying these weapons around. Because naturally, and she told the whole story, which I forget right now, about how some Brahmin fell down because he had a weapon. I think the demigods wanted to have a Brahmin fall down, so they gave the Brahmin a weapon. Because naturally, if you have a weapon, I mean, if you were to put a gun in my hands right now, I'm not saying I would shoot you all. But, you know, the natural impulse is to pick it up, you know, like that. Not just say, oh, hell no. You know, not just look at it. You want to pick it up. I mean, just like yesterday, I'll give a practical example. I was going to take my walk, and I saw a weapon. You know, Nima had a weapon. It was a water squirter. So, you know, I couldn't just, like, restrain myself. I couldn't. I had no control. You know, I just saw it, picked it up, and and, you know, I had to, it took all my effort to not shoot Nimai with it. So these things, actually, Kshatriyas are always in touch with their weapons. Of course, Yudhisthira Maharaj was expert with the stick and spear fighting. That was his expertise. Each of the Pandavas had their specific expertise. Of course, Arjuna with the bow and arrow, and Bhimsen with the glove. So that's why he needed a Brahmin with him. And also, it's the system. Yudhisthira was Dharmaraj, which means a Kshatriya should have... This thing went off again. Anyway. So a Kshatriya should have a Brahmin with him. I mean, even if the Kshatriya was perfectly qualified, the Kshatriya would always want to keep a Brahmin because that's Dharma. It's like, you know, part of his sadhana or part of his Dharma to keep a Brahmin with him. So, does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
So, any other questions?
I have
one. Okay. Yeah.
Maharaj, you touched on the Bhishmadeva, the Dravacharya. They were eating in the kitchen of Duryodhana, so they were affected by his
consciousness, yeah.
His consciousness. So there's a bit of a move in his government. There's the different like restaurants that are, you know, non-devoted restaurants that are pure vegetarian.
Yeah.
Some devotees think, well, granted, it's vegetarian. We can just go there and offer it to Krishna, it's all fine. Like the other day, and there's some Krishna restaurants, ISKCON restaurants that are, you know, it's dubious who the cooks are. And,
yeah.
You know, whether they're even following the principles or can you make some comment on such
Well, I just know, I don't want to comment directly on that, but whenever I eat, I make sure, you know, I figure out who's cooking. I won't eat unless I know the cook. I mean, that's just my standard. Because I'm afraid of Maya. I'm afraid of diluting my Krishna consciousness. So I have to know the cook, or I cook myself. I cook myself a lot for myself. Actually, not while I'm traveling so much. But when I'm in Govardhan, unless there's someone there, I always have a brahmachari there, don't worry. But even if I have a brahmachari there, I won't let him cook. My brahmachari is just in Govardhan. He said, I want to cook for you. I said, you're not cooking for me. He said, why not? I said, I don't want your consciousness. Actually, one of my dear disciples, Gokulendra. Some of you may know Gokulendra. He's a very nice devotee. I mean, he's part of the 24-hour kirtan party in Vrindavan. And I cook, and then he eats what I cook. And then he comes to me and he says, I'm a brahmachari. I'm meant to eat more opulently. I need sweets. And I say to him, if you want to stay a brahmachari, you won't eat sweets. And then we have this whole argument. That's funny. So, yeah. So that's my point. You have to be careful what you eat and who's cooking again.
Yeah, on that point, previously, brahmanas wouldn't make their wives cook because they're always cooking themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, probably made that comment that even if they join the army or somehow, they have their own little kitchens. I'm not suggesting that, you know. That's a little too much. Yeah, that's true. Do you eat your wife's cooking? That's good.
But then isn't it
Maharaj, that, you know, the intention that it is cooked with love, we do not have that particular standard. However, should we not accept anyway, because based on the intention that it is cooked with good consciousness and with love?
Well, I mean, how many of us actually have love, but at least we should figure out if they're following the regular principles. I mean, it's not that we give a love test.
No.
To the cook. They give a love test to the cook. But, yeah, I mean, at least we should make sure the cook is following four regulated principles and, you know, chanting and everything like that. Also, Krishna doesn't have to accept. I mean, Jinya Kovacha will tell you this, that the deity is a person. So if the food is, if it's not cooked cleanly, with wrong consciousness, Krishna may not accept. I mean, there's actually stories, maybe you know stories like this, that the devotees offered things that was, you know, that Krishna didn't want. They went to the altar and it was all on the floor. You seen that happen sometimes?
Yeah, it was in San
Francisco. Yeah, it was just all on the floor. And even one time, it was in San Diego, the devotees went into the temple. There's Jagannath Baladeva and Subhadra, and Subhadra was gone. And they asked Prabhupada, you know, there was just a burnt spot where Subhadra was. And they asked Prabhupada, Prabhupada said it was because of offenses Subhadra left. So, you know, and then there was the other story, I think Nishin Kovacs has heard me tell that, where the devotees in the temple, or it was a non-ISKCON temple, were not treating Vaishnavas properly, and Prabhupada said there was no deity in the temple. And the devotee said to Prabhupada, yes, we saw the deity. Prabhupada said, you heard what I said, there's no deity. Because they were doing something that Prabhupada equated to using the Shalagram Shila to crack nuts with. Because they didn't have the right consciousness, that even though it appeared that there was a deity, the deity had left. So, I mean, it's really based, something becoming prasadam is based on consciousness. I mean, we do say the prayers and everything like that, but even if you say the prayers and the consciousness is horrible, Krishna may not accept, Krishna. So the consciousness has to be at the highest level to work, especially that of Krishna. Yeah?
It would be something like massage, getting massage.
Yeah.
Getting massage.
Yeah, you get a karmic transfer when you get. And something like someone touching your feet. If you, you know, if you happen to be like a sannyasi or something, people try to touch your feet. And then later on, you should try to touch their head, give them back their karma. That's why you generally see the sadhus touch people's heads. It's not that they're blessing them. It's that they're giving them back the karma. You know, there's a karma transfer. Someone touches your feet, your shoes, or anything like that. And then the next morning you wake up with a fever. And you want, or you have a dream of Godzilla in the middle of the night. So who touched my feet? Then you have to do Ashwamedha yoga. Not really. So, any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, well, we have to keep some topic.
Yeah.
How the consciousness of Dronacharya and
Kripacharya
and Bhishma were was polluted by the prasadam. It was not directly cooked by the yoga.
It was cooked by people that Duryodhana, as they say in India, his chumchas. I don't think you know what that means. His yes man, as I would say in English. You know, just like people of the same quality. I mean, you pick people who cook for you who have that quality, generally. I mean, if I had to pick people who cook for me, I'd try to pick them of a similar quality to myself. That's not to say people cook. So I don't know if you're sure you'll say, well, I have similar qualities of my guru. I said, I try. I'm not always successful. So, obviously he picked his cooks who would cook for him. And just the atmosphere itself was polluted. So therefore when Krishna, and the story of course is when Krishna went to try to make peace, he didn't eat with Duryodhana. He refused to. He ate with Vidura and just ate some simple. He preferred to eat porridge, you know, simple porridge, rather than the opulent food that Duryodhana was offering him. So that's a famous story, of course, in the Mahabharata. So we should be like that too. If there's any question, just eat raw food or something. Like when Prabhupada would go to someone's house and they weren't vegetarians, Prabhupada would just take fruit or some raw food or something like that. So you know, Prabhupada was very strict about that. Of course, you know, what was the story? Oh yeah, sometimes I take devotees on tours of India, and it's really hard for them to control their senses. You know, I tell the devotees, you know, you see these street vendors who are cooking samosas in motor oil. I mean, you don't know how old the oil is or where it came from. You know what I'm talking about in the street lecture. It's completely black because it's been used for the last 200 years. and you tell them, don't do it. And then as soon as you turn your back, they're buying them. And then I had some interesting, I had a train trip in South India. I was guiding the devotees on the tour, we were in the train. So the devotees snuck out and bought these samosas. And because they didn't want to appear in front of me, they went to eat them in the toilet. So you had like two or three of them sitting in this little tiny Indian toilet, which is so polluted to begin with, you know. It's disgusting. I mean, even to use it as a toilet is disgusting. And so, but the funny thing is that that's the time I have to use the toilet. So I open the door, and you know, the train's running, and then, you know, the bottom of the toilet, you can actually see the tracks, and you know, it just falls on the tracks. And so I go open the door, and there are these devotees huddled in the corner. He didn't have samosas. And then 2 days later, they both got extremely sick with high fever. And I had to help cure them through different means. So, yeah.
I was listening to one of the classes that I think you gave at New Goloka.
Yeah.
And you were speaking about how it's acceptable in different cultures, for example, to eat dogs.
Yeah.
And that, and you were kind of cautioning the devotees that, you know, you were kind of saying, believe you me, if we were in that situation, we would be pretty much doing the same, so
yeah.
Don't be too cuffed up. Could you please elaborate a little bit on that?
If we were born in such a situation, not now, of course, but if we were born in such a situation, then we would be following the culture. I mean, naturally, whatever culture you're born in, unless you happen to be like Prahlad Maharaj, and you've had instruction by Narada Muni when you're in the womb of your mother, you will follow that culture. I mean, that's my background. You know, I followed the culture I was in. Eventually, when I grew up, I had some discrimination. I became a vegetarian before I became Krishna conscious. But when you're young, I mean, how can you do anything different? So we shouldn't find fault, too much fault in these people, because they're following the culture. And when they're exposed or given higher knowledge, then they can change. Anybody can change if they're given the right association.
Does it also mean that if we were to go and live in such a country or such a climate, that we could also gradually become desensitized? And
yeah, definitely. I mean, we can become desensitized to anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like we have in ISKCON, we were used to be so strict in ISKCON, and now things are going on in ISKCON that we would never accept before. And I'm not going to get into the details about that, but I mean, it's interesting also, devotees, we have this one holiday in the United States called Thanksgiving, anyone's heard of that before, where everybody eats turkey. So sometimes the devotees make a vegetarian turkey to eat. Tofu turkey, yeah, you know about that. And it's just like imitation sin. I mean, I just can't relate to it. I mean, if you're going to be a vegetarian, why are you going to imitate meat? I mean, it may be good for bringing people to the movement, but after you've been in the movement 20 or 30 years, I mean, I think the desire to eat turkey would hopefully go away. Yes. Yes, Vaishnava.
How much, other day you were talking about Jiva Doria, and then at the same time also, we hear about these principles that we shouldn't eat from someone who's not following the principles and things like that. So how do we, the internal mood and what should we be thinking and how do we develop it? We need to be merciful. At the same time, we also need to protect the standards and protect the rest of the people.
Yeah, so when you... That's good. Yeah, so when you go to let's say you go to someone's house, then you can basically boil at the most boil food. You know, actually my diet it's not a problem because that's what I eat anyway. And sometimes you know I just tell people I'm on a raw diet, which is true. Sometimes I went 2 years just on a raw diet. So. Yeah, you get used to it after a while. It's very nice. I mean, I was on a raw diet where I wasn't even juicing. I was just eating the whole vegetables and fruits the way they were. And I was very healthy that year, those 2 years. But then I went to Fiji. I mean, it changed stuff. So, I mean, you know, apply that with intelligence. I mean, for example, when I go home to visit my mother, then, you know, I let her boil some vegetables for me. You know, if I just say that my mind will become wicked by eating the food cooked by you, Mom, I think that wouldn't go over very well. So I don't do that. You know, there's certain exceptions you make. You have to be careful of making those exceptions. Especially, there's no need for us to go to restaurants that where there's devotees not cooking. There's no need. There's no need for us to buy chips at the store. Although, the senses are so voracious and uncontrollable, as we say in the Prashana prayer, it's the most difficult sense to control, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like having the tongue controls us, and it's just like the tail wagging the dog instead of the dog wagging the tail.
Mm-hmm.
The tongue is wagging us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's true. So we have to somehow or other learn how to control the tongue. Of course, by taking prasadam, but also by accepting everything favorable, rejecting everything. Yeah, that should be our sense of discrimination. Is this favorable for my advancement? Is eating this going to be favorable?
Mm.
Even though it tastes good.
Mm.
You know, if you want to go to Pizza Hut or something like that, you have Pizza Hut here in Australia? You know, even though it tastes good. I mean, one time, another funny story is, there's some devotees who live next to me in the United States, you know, I have a house and everything. So sometimes they're getting delivery of Pizza Hut. You know how they deliver pizza. So one time they came to my house. Pizza Hut delivery. I said, what? So, anyway, it happens. Yeah.
A little controversial, but how can you explain Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, when he had it, she bought something off a train platform, the way
yeah.
He said, you know, it wasn't very prepared by devotees. He said, well, if you pay for it,
it becomes purified. Yeah, it becomes purified, Prabhupada said. Yeah, so there's also that instruction from Prabhupada. That's when you have nothing else to eat. You know, actually survival has a higher priority. I mean, for example, you know, Prabhupada even said if we were somewhere where there were no vegetables, you know that story?
Yeah.
Then we can eat fish or something like that. I said that to a devotee one time. You know, this devotee was getting me all worried about World War III. And he said, World War III, everything will be radioactive, you won't have anything to eat. And I was in a place that was right by the sea then. I said, well, then I'll just eat fish. He said, what? You malecha! But I said, you know, that's survival. You know, not under those circumstances. But probably wouldn't do that. If he was at a temple, he had a cook and everything like that, and then he would send the devotees, oh, please buy some pakoras somewhere else for us. So there's certain circumstances. Like I said, you have to be a little flexible sometimes. But in most cases, in Australia, you're not going to starve to death. I mean, even, I'll tell you the practical story. When I first started doing traveling sankirtan, myself and another sannyasi, we were doing traveling sankirtan. We thought, or at least he told me, that now that we're sannyasis, we don't have to follow so many rules anymore.
Oh.
We can wake up any time in the morning. And I thought, this is great. Don't have to wake up early. And we could just go to the store and just buy whatever we need to do. You know, we're buying salad dressing and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it didn't have onions and garlic. So, and the way we did our offerings, he would take the the bag of groceries, put it to his head and say, Shri Vishnu, Shri Vishnu, Shri Vishnu, and then dig in after that. So what we discovered is after 2 or 3 days, our consciousness was going down. And so then we resolved to cook, even though we were traveling in a van. We eventually got one of these gas stoves, you know, where you pump up the gas stove. And I had to cook chapatis, rolling them on the wheel well. You know what a wheel well is? In the back of one of the empty vans, you know, where the wheel is, on top of the wheel, there's a, it's metal, because it goes up like this. And so I used that as a place to roll the chapatis. And so I was cooking chapatis, and we both, and him particularly, insisted on it to keep our consciousness pure. So at that point, we changed our whole diet. And, you know, we were buying, previously, we were buying bread, you know, whole wheat bread, everything like that, but it was affecting the consciousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, just to comment on that, and it's just a personal comment, that me and Marty Bruce from Canberra, the temple president, we had a pizza in that somewhere in Canada when we were doing some sangha time, and we bought bona fide products, cheese without branding, yeah, and everything, and vegetarian. We explained to the guy how a wood-fired oven, you know, keep it separate from the meat area, put the pizza, everything. But because we figured out the result was he cooked it. It was an omnivoted cook who understood our needs. However, we had the most outrageous argument after that. And, of course, Artie and myself have always been known for our loving relationship. And we did have a very, very big argument immediately after that. So it's definitely the consciousness is infused.
Yeah, you experienced that.
Yeah, you experienced.
You experienced that. And I mean, I've had experiences where I've had to be with non-devotees for several days. I mean, sometimes I go to, I was at this seminar on what's called non-violent communication. When I was getting trained up how to do empathic communication, it was like a 10-day seminar headed up by this person, Marshall Rosenberg, who's passed away since then. And what I went to do, I just went to the supermarket and purchased raw food. I ate raw food. And that was it. And then, and you know, because in these seminars we all sit at the same table and eat, so I brought my raw food out and everything like that. And they were eating meat. Unfortunately, they weren't too empathic. So one time, the cook came out and announced, we have something very special for dinner tonight. We have, and she mentioned a certain type of chicken, which I forget right now. She said, we have this wonderful chicken for dinner, and I couldn't control myself. I yelled out, what about empathy for the chicken? You know, because it was 10 days of empathy seminars. It was called an intensive, like a nonviolent communication intensive. And they all looked at me, you know, whack! Shut up, what about empathy for the cook? And I said, but the poor chicken! So, you know, sometimes most of the times people confine their empathy or sympathy for human beings. Yeah. That's called speciesism. Just like we don't like sexism or anything like that, so we don't like speciesism. Either. So so I was eating raw food, and some of the people began to like it. I actually brought some devotee bliss bars with me at the same time and passed them out to everybody. So I was passing out prasad and food. And I grew my own sprouts. Because we all had our individual rooms, so I had these mung beans, and I sprouted them every day. And I was happy. You could live very simply. I mean, it's not that you need all this opulent food to live. It's just in our minds. It's really in our minds that we need all this stuff. Sanatana Goswami, he was just eating dried bread balls. And his Didi complained to him about it. You know, Madame Mohan said, what is this, you know? No salt? And then Sanatana Goswami said, you know, I'm supposed to do all this service for Lord Chaitanya. I don't have time to get you salt. If you want salt, you got to get it yourself. And the Didi got salt, a whole boatload of salt. You know, so you have these devotees like Sanatana Goswami or Raghunath Das Goswami. I mean, what to speak of his renunciation, eating rejected rice that even the cows wouldn't touch. He just washed it with water
and put a little salt on it and ate it. And Lord Chaitanya said, why are you keeping all this nice prasad for yourself? So one more question because it's getting late. Yeah.
You all eat too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, everybody eats too much.
Fasting is the most important and most beneficial.
Yeah, that's why we have a policy. You know,
practice it, though.
Every 2 weeks.
And actually, it's only the first day, but we suffer. After the first day, you get happier. You actually feel better.
Yeah, so that's why we have a policy in the Krishna Consciousness Movement. And it is a fact, the Ayurvedas give us, you know, you eat as much food as you can fit in the palm of the hand. I don't follow that because I'm not that sense controlled. But, you know, the Ayurveda talks about filling your stomach with air and water and then whatever's left over, you know, food. So, yeah, it's a good point. We all, I mean, not everybody, I'm sure you don't, but the rest of us eat too much. One more question, then. Yeah, I mean, obviously, the prepared food that you buy, you know, any of this canned food or stuff like that is prepared. Also, they use either, what is it called, BPA on the can, which is highly poisonous, or they used to use pig fat on the cans, especially when you have tomatoes, canned tomatoes. The tomatoes would corrode the can, so they need some harsh chemical or pig fat to protect the can. You may not know that. So that's why we don't offer canned food to the deities. It's very contaminated. So, you know, we should stay away from prepared food. I don't take cereals or anything like that. The only time Prabhupada would take something that was like half cooked was like puffed rice. Mm-hmm. He would have the devotees buy that because it's very hard to do that ourselves. I mean, there's a whole system of sand, how they do it in India, but I never mastered that system. Okay, Srini Prabhupada is giving us the hook. All glories to His divine grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, ki jai, Lord Premananda. Srila Prabhupada, ki jai.